Okay. So I thought I was going to be the now for something completely different talk, and I probably still am, although if you were listening closely to Craig, that was sort of a taste of something rather different than at least all the previous talks that I heard today. So I wanted to start by telling you this great story that a colleague of mine, Mike Best, who works in international affairs and is very interested in internet and communications technologies in developing countries, told me. So something happened to him about a month ago. He was in a rural part of Africa, and he was with a design team, and they were meeting with the Acholi people, and those happened to be some Acholi children. This is a very poor area. They were meeting with essentially the leaders of these different tribes, and they were talking to them about technology, but they were following the practices of this people who do this sort of thing, which is that you try not to be very presumptuous about what people are going to want. And so when you talk to them about their needs and their requirements, you try not to assume that they're going to want anything in particular. You try to talk in generalities. And so he said they'd been talking for about half an hour, and finally this Acholi chief said, "We want the internet, unless you have something better." So much for not trying to spell out what they were gonna want. All right. So what are these? So thanks to the internet, I can show you these pictures. One of these is an internet topology. The other is these Acholi children in this international displaced persons camp. Also thanks to the internet, I cannot tell you the original source of either of these because they came from Wikipedia, and so I have no idea where the Where I can give you Wikipedia as the source, but I can't give you the original source. Okay, so I don't know if I need to say this, but I will say this. I mean, where are we, right? Where are we with the current internet? Well, even as recently as last week, one, meaning me, could receive an email like this. This is an email we've all received many, many times before, although I will note that now they say, "Don't think this is one of those scam or junk emails," because myself receive also, okay? So this guy, he receives these junk emails. So this isn't one of them because, he's one of us who's getting these. Okay, so we're seeing these sorts of things. This is a slide that I got from Nick Feimster. It's a little bit dated. He put it together for his job talk, and so which is the time when everyone writes the very best talk of their life. Showing incidents of various kinds of problems related to routing, some growing, some shrinking, black holes particularly growing. None of these details are important. This is a slide I got from David Dagan, who works in the security area at Georgia Tech, showing the incidents of poisoned records following the August 8th, 2008 Black Hat talk on a particular vulnerability. I would notice that I think there's a correlation between the number of poisoned records and what the current financial health of the company being listed. So perhaps DNS poisonings might be an early indicator of a company about to go through financial difficulty. If they can't afford to have decent IT, they apparently, may not be able to afford to do a good job of the rest of their business. And then, just because I love this cartoon, and I think it's at least as appropriate now as it was in, I think, 1993 or the early to mid-1990s. This is the "On the Internet, nobody knows you're a dog" slide. So, we have many instances in which we don't know who it is that we are communicating with, who it is that we are interacting with when we interact on the internet. So the internet has been an amazing thing. It's led to a tremendous number of really wonderful, fantastic applications. But it's also got sort of a variety of problems. When I gave portions of this talk last week, and one of the things I said was that, there are now applications that when they came about within the last 4 or 5 years, they were great, and I used them, and I'm now afraid to use them. And so one of the examples is this electronic gift cards. My mom is sending me a birthday card, and it used to be that that happened on my birthday, and it was from my mom. And then I started to get suspicious. And so, you know, even if I saw that, I would just make a mental note. When I talk to my mom, I'm going to thank her for that, or at least check to see if she sent it. But I'm not going to open it. I'm not going to open it because that would be dangerous. So I think we have passed a point where the number of things that we trust to do on the internet is probably, for many of us, past its peak and is actually in some level of decline, the things that you would trust to do. It's always a little tough to talk to a very diverse audience. So there are some people in this audience who have been there since the beginning, and there are others who don't even know what I'm talking about when I say that. Let me apologize to both of you for probably doing justice to neither. Hopefully there are some of you in the middle, and you'll all feel fine. Long back when Genie got going, there was something called the Genie Science Council. And the Genie Science Council did a lot of very good and hard work putting together a set of ideas and research agenda about the kind of research that might be enabled by a large-scale experimental facility. But that effort got itself sort of inside a box that I sometimes call the justify the facility box. So there was the facility development and the agenda development were sort of proceeding in some parallel fashion, and sometimes the facility development was getting ahead of the research agenda development, and that led to sort of a difficult place. So with some influence from Jeanette Wing and others in conversation, we replaced the Genie Science Council with something called the Network Science and Engineering Council. And that council, the Network Science and Engineering Council, which I think I probably should have changed the order of these a little bit, is articulating a research agenda in the network science and engineering area. It is not as its first order of business attempting to justify a facility, any particular facility, though it is, as its perhaps second order of business, identifying the places where experimental facilities seem to be particularly useful to advance the research agenda. A number of people who were on the Genie Science Council have carried over to the Network Science and Engineering Council, so there's some continuity. There are also some new faces. So that group is articulating the intellectual space, which I've sort of summarized as understanding how to design, engineer, and operate better networks. And that better is actually, it's a coincidence that this is what this Acholi chief said, you know, that I actually had this slide written before he said he wants the internet unless you have something better. But so the space, the approach that we are taking is to start in the sort of center with network design and engineering and then ask what other intellectual fields, what other pieces are there that would have a bearing on design and engineering of networks. And so there's been a network science and theoretical computer science piece. There's a societal values piece. There's an economics and behavior piece. And I'm going to show you in a minute some examples from those. It is possible, maybe it's even probable, that there's something that we're missing. And so if you think you have a candidate for that, I would really appreciate it if you would find me or send me email and tell me what you think it is. And if you don't do so quickly, it's going to be a hole for some period of time, for a while, because we are in fact on track to writing down this research agenda within fairly short order, synthesizing from a set of activities that have been going on over the last couple of months. So we've had three workshops, Science of Network Design. John Doyle and John Rakowski, who's here, co-led that workshop. There was a workshop on behavior, computation, and networks that Michael Kearns from Penn and Colin Kammerer from Caltech organized. And there was recently a workshop on network design and societal values that Helen Nissenbaum and Dave Clark organized. There have also been two meetings. I called them meetings because they were smaller than the workshops. And they were the previous workshops, while there had been some, certainly network science has gotten a bunch of attention in certain contexts, the science of network design and the other two workshops were largely treading in ground that had not been considered under the previous Genie effort. The network design and engineering had gotten a lot of good attention, and so we had a workshop to try to extract out of those things what seemed to be most important. And then John Byers and Joan Feigenbaum and I got together in Boston for a day and talked about work that the theory community, theoretical computer science community, had been doing on network on problems in networking. Theory of Network Computing, Network Computation was the name of the effort that they had been through. So we're in the middle of this timeline of these workshops and meetings and then synthesizing a research agenda from them. We have reports from most of the meetings, at least in preliminary form, and workshops, and we're in a process of synthesizing and integrating those. I hear Chip promised that we are going to... Chip gave some January date for something to be done. Oh, you didn't? Oh, I don't know. Susie, there you go. Somebody who would commit to a date. So Susie's committed us to a date. We're reasonably on track. So I wanted to just give you a sense of some of the things that have happened in these different workshops and meetings, just so you understand some of this space. So I'm going to go through these four. They're going to be pretty short. This is my second favorite cartoon. This is the one, the math, does everybody know this cartoon? There's like a math formula, and then there's a blank space, and it says, then a miracle occurs, and the guy says, I think you should be more explicit here in step two. Okay, so these are some of the themes that came out of the Science of Design workshop, and I'm going to invite John to jump in at any time if he feels compelled to do so. So I'm listing three here. One is models and model validation. So the importance of semantics in models and the importance in model validation of moving from observational models to generative or predictive models. I'm glossing over these. I'm going to give you an example in a minute. You're welcome to ask me a question if you want to about more precisely what this means, but primarily I'm giving you the flavor, I'm not giving you the details. Second theme has to do with the derivation of architectures and the ways in which optimization frameworks can be constructed and can lead to some insight about the placement of functionality and so architectural decision making. Not as a turn the crank, you get the answer, but sort of as a step trying to help fill in this gap. I think the observation was that there's almost certainly still a miracle that occurs. It's more you could say, well, it's a place where common sense or art or experience comes into play that's very hard to quantify, but it's a way of pushing a little further from requirements towards architecture while still acknowledging that this notion that you have a wealth of experience that you draw upon is important. Dave Clark gave a really nice talk and explained how he'd been doing some reading about building architectures who build architects who design real physical buildings and some inspiration from them and this notion that you have examples but you also try to drive down requirements. It's those two things together that produce great designs. Okay, and then the last one, and this is actually echoed in many places, is the local and global interactions. And this is, I'm waving my hands a lot, but the notion that, there are local decision making going on, yet it's a global system, and so there are some overall global properties. And there may be ways that you can constrain the local decision-making to produce global properties that are desirable or analyze the local decision-making so that you can infer things about global properties. I mean, this generally is in this hand-waving world in which things happen in the small, but there's a system which is the large, and the things that happen in the small are determining what is happening in the large. All right. This is just an example that is in this vein of global results from local actions. The global result here is the topology, the topological structure of the internet. The local actions are the additions of routers and edges that go on, decisions being made by ISPs, not being coordinated across the whole network. And so the picture you see here, well, you're seeing two cartoons sort of internet topologies that have the same power law parameters, so the same degree. So some of the workshop topics included things like how might behavioral experiments be scaled up? And I'm going to show you the results of a behavioral experiment in a minute that was done with 40 people. How does the web and internet affect these behavioral experiments? How could it help scale them up? What are the appropriate statistical models for collective behavioral data? This is really starting to go to modeling how crowds work, modeling how collective behavior occurs, and to the extent that that's occurring over networks, what role does the network play, and how might you capture that in a model? So, if I change the heading, the heading in here is the democratic primary game. So we could just call this, to make it very timely, let's just call this the United States national presidential election game. So this is an experiment that Mike Kearns did at UPenn, and the setup is the following. You get a collection of people in a room. They each are looking at a screen. They have a payoff, and they can color their own. They pick a color, red or blue, and they're going to have a chance to continually update this red or blue. And for this particular player, if everybody converges on red, they get 75 cents. And if everybody converges on blue, they get $1.25. Okay? So this player is motivated to try to end up at blue. Okay? But if they don't converge, nobody gets anything. And each user has a particular view, can see the colors for a subset of the other participants. So there's a graph. There's a network graph that tells who can see which other participants. So you might, for instance, only be able to see one. I might only be able to see Craig's color. And so here I am, blue. And Craig might have red. And I may decide to stay on blue for a while and see if he'll change. Depending on what sort of reasoning I'm doing, I may eventually change to red if he stays at red. Okay, so this is three snapshots of this experiment being run. So each blob is for a separate experiment. On the x-axis is time, so they have a certain amount of time to try to get everyone to converge. And I believe, I believe they've all converged at the point in time which it shows. So even though you see some red, and the next cycle it all switched to blue, you can see from the and there's one row per person. So you're getting to see over time the color changes that a person is making. So you can see some stubborn people, right? They just aren't going to change. You know, they don't want to change. You can see some changes in the initial configuration. So, for example, in the bottom plot, it actually starts out with a lot more red nodes, that is, nodes preferring red, yet still converges to blue, and that's because of the topological structure of the network by which they can see one another, and the small number of initial blues are in positions of influence, and they have led others to end up choosing blue. All right, so who will win the presidential election? I'll leave that as to be seen next week. All right, so this meeting was quite an eye opener for me, and I think for the other techie sorts of people who were there, a few NSF people, and then some folks from the GPO. All right, so that gives you a flavor of that. This network design and engineering meeting was a lot more like what you probably would imagine coming from the backgrounds that you come from. So I'm just pulling out three themes, and none of these will be very surprising to you, but I think they do help to capture some of the significant challenge in future network design. So one is this complexity of the requirements. And you know, as an example of this, should a future internet achieve 5.9's reliability? Well, How many people think a future internet should achieve 99.9% reliability? Don't be afraid. It's not a meaningful question. Okay. Sorry? Without cost, why not? Yeah. So it's not a very well-formed question, right? There are challenges even in creating, turning that into a well-formed question, much less having an answer, understanding whether that should be a requirement or not. And there are plenty of other examples where we talk about requirements in a way that is not well-formed and is not in a larger context by which we could really understand. So if we were to do that, what would we be trading off? What would it cost? If we were to achieve that level of privacy, what would we be trading off in security, et cetera? So complexity of requirements. And I think sometimes it's possible to go down a hole in which you feel like you really need to say, these are the requirements. And if you don't know that, you're sort of stuck. And I think we need to recognize that stating the requirements and understanding the trade-offs is itself a research problem and an important research problem. Second one is abundance of technology. And Craig likes to say that, you know, we could program all the way down to the waveform. Okay, so what does it mean? How would you enable on-the-fly composition that would go potentially all the way down to waveforms? Do you want to do that? What's it useful for? If you were going to try to support experimentation to do that, what would that look like? So not only sort of top-to-bottom ability to program, but also wide heterogeneity, all kinds of options available. So if you think about, you know, if you had some requirements and you now think about the design space available to you to meet those requirements, you have this abundance of technological options that are just greater than we've had before in terms of ability to realize a solution. And then the last one, which is a little, I left it on even though it's probably doesn't need to really be said in this audience, but this need for experimentation and that group that got together, was really committed to the value that experimentation plays in our field, and the importance of, you know, not that every experiment provides insight. In fact, doing good experimentation is really hard, and I think that's something that we don't acknowledge enough, that there is work to be done to make sure that when we do experiments that they provide insight and they don't just help us get our paper in because there's a checkbox about doing an experiment. All right, I think I'll skip that example. So this is the last one I'm going to talk about. So this workshop was pretty fascinating. So this is what happened to me while I was there. I would be listening to someone talking, and I would be pretty sure I knew what they were talking about, and they would be in a sentence. And all of a sudden, the sentence would contain a word, which there was no possible way that word could be in that sentence for the meaning that I had been assuming up to that point. And I don't, you know, this doesn't happen to me very often. Mostly I talk to my computer science colleagues, and, you know, when they say pointer, I know what that means. And, you know, I talk to my family, and when they say pointer, I know what that means. It's something completely different. But this was lawyers and humanists, which I didn't even know there was such a thing, social scientists and just a variety of really fascinating people. John Kleinberg was there for someone closer to the computer science sort of part of the world. And it was really very interesting. I actually, one of the lessons I learned was that my double major undergraduate in engineering really didn't provide a very good foundation, liberal arts kind of foundation for participating in these conversations. All right, so here are some example issues that came out of that. You know, some of these are ones that you sort of would expect, but I think it was a little bit striking how much attention they got. those issues, you know, issues of security, privacy, identity, and trust. The openness, the value of openness, if any of you have read Jonathan, what is his last name? Zittart? What? No, that's not it, is it? The future of the internet and how to stop it? Zittrain. Sorry, you said it right. Jonathan Zittrain's book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. 5 minutes, okay. And this openness element is very critical, a critical part of the argument of that book and one that got a lot of discussion. Conditions and motivations for participation. I think Craig touched some on that when he was talking about the user opt-in. And then there were some cross-cutting kinds of themes, visibility and transparency, incentives, again, which could tie into motivations for participation, and then networks as experimental environments and the valuable role that those can play. So these folks are actually very eager to be able to experiment with alternative network environments and find out how people respond to them. All right. This is a reminder that we actually have only succeeded in some parts of the world. And I think this is the second to last slide. So this is a slide from some work that my colleagues at Georgia Tech are doing, Becky Grinter and Keith Edwards. They're HCI people, and Keith is an HCI slash systems person. And they did this experiment where they asked people to draw their home networks. And this is hard to see, but it's two pictures of the same home network. And the one on the left is just like what you and I would draw, right? It's got the Epson color printer, and it's got those curly lines, which means that, you know, wireless bits are going through the air, and there's a laptop, and there's another laptop, different people's laptops, and all that sort of thing. That's exactly what we would draw. And the one on the right, there's a bed, and the bed has a laptop on it, and above there's a desk, and the desk has a laptop on it, and then there's a sidewalk, because this is like a flat that goes above and below the ground or something, and there are still some squiggly lines, but you know, this is the way real people, many real people, think about their networks. That is, you know, how do they use them? Where are people when they're using different devices? And rather than you know, this picture on the left. So among the kind of research challenges that I think are emerging from these workshops, and this is sort of my own list. It has very little to do with being comprehensive across the set of workshops, but this human network interface questions of many sorts, and I include management in that category. Materially more secure networks without sacrificing, or with the appropriate balance with this openness criteria. Networking and computing for the other 80%, that is at the margins. Maybe they're the other 20%, but actually that curve, those in some countries, they really are the other 80%. I happen to be quite interested in mobility and in unified treatments of mobility. Circuit switching to packet switching to network switching, the science of network design. So I always don't hate it when people say, it's not your father's X, okay? So it's not your mother's, your physicist mother's network science, all right? It's the network science for today. And then just this wealth of new technologies and that are coming, some on unclear time scales, that could make a big difference to the way that we use networks, to the way that we build networks, including quantum, multi-core, many-core, and programmability all the way down to the waveform. All right, so thank you, and I'm happy to take questions and feedback now or later. Yes? Yeah. So the question is, did in the behavioral workshop, was there any discussion about human behavior in the sense of risk-taking and bad behavior and why people engage in those kinds of things? So the answer is not directly, although one of the reasons why I'm now afraid to do a lot of things is that it's a business, right? This bad stuff, it's not fun. It's not just for fun. It's a business. And so, to the extent that there are economic models underlying the business of doing bad things on the internet, I think they may well have something to share. To say, they these fields, to my taste, they're really in their infancy, in the sense of takeaways that, you know, we could go use to. So you know, it's a little shocking to me how, I mean, these people who are doing this behavioral kind of work are really at the edges and the fringes, maybe, of their fields.
So isn't that a good reason for NSF to support that?
Isn't that a good reason for NSF to support that stuff? I mean, those, they would say absolutely that they would love to see it supported. And they already do. They already do. Susie's a... But, you know, it is in surprisingly early stages, I think, just speaking as a total outsider. Yes?
A long time ago, I discovered that if it is called science, it usually isn't. Uh-huh. Network science doesn't seem to be an exception. And if you notice, when computer scientists behave well, they are inducted to the Academy of Engineering, not of Science. And we really have to think about it as engineering, not as science, even though from time to time there are some mathematical problems that are science. Most of what we do is engineering and should be treated as such.
John, do you want to respond?
Architecture example is really the core of it. We are starting to understand how to treat some things on a rigorous basis that we did not treat before on a rigorous basis. And you can call that science or you can call it engineering. It's a little bit of both. And it's really the power of analysis, understanding, and then design all together. And I don't think we need to split that into two separate fields. I just think we need to do it.
Okay. Thank you.